forum is entitled, How Do We Prevent the Nuclear War? And I'd like to begin our forum tonight with a scripture reading from Deuteronomy, the 30th chapter, the 19th verse. I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore choose life, that you and your descendants may live.
Thermonuclear weapons, thermonuclear weapons, thermonuclear weapons, thermonuclear weapons. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would die. So just look at them and cry. And know they kill you.
Tonight, as we begin to examine this, I'd like to proceed with a little bit of an introduction, a few minutes, and then open this up as a general forum, give everybody a chance to express their opinions, ask questions. I'd like to start out checking two assumptions, which I have tonight. The first is the assumption that nobody wants a nuclear war. Is there anybody here that does not share that? Anybody that wants a nuclear war? Okay, that's a safe assumption. The second is that we are called to be instruments of God's love in the world, called to be peacemakers. Is that a safe assumption? Okay. Very good. I'd like to begin by quickly going over what we've been discussing the last couple of days and giving everybody a little bit of a framework to begin with. First of all, you have a couple questions about this clock in the upper right-hand corner of the chalkboard behind me. The clock is a representation of what the Union of Concerned Scientists puts out every quarter. It's called the Doomsday Clock. And what they do is they set the hands between 15 minutes before midnight and midnight to try and convey what, in their best estimate, is some degree, some way to convey the degree of urgency that our problems, that the problems we have present us with in relation primarily to nuclear war. The hands have been close to midnight at one time, and that was a number of years ago in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now the problem, the basic problem here is the number that is right below the clock, the number is 53,000. If you were at any of the sessions, we would, of course, know that that refers to the number of nuclear weapons which are in the world today. 52,000 of these are shared between the United States and Russia. The other 1,000 are split between Britain, France, China, and India. I should point out that the number of countries in the nuclear club is expected to reach 40 by 1985. There are many countries right on the verge or who have it already, and some have estimated that it would be as high as 100 by the year 2000. Okay, back to the present. 31,000 of these 53,000 weapons are United States weapons, belong to our country, and 9,000 of these are strategic, which means they're designed for major confrontation. Primarily at this time with the Soviet Union. I'd also like to point out that at this time there are still only 218 cities in all of the Soviet Union with a population of more than 100,000. That becomes important when we think of deterrence. What all of this boils down to, that 53,000 number, is an allocation of the explosive equivalent of 3 tons of TNT for every man, woman, and child on the planet. Now, if you looked at this poster I had up today, they were only claiming 2 tons.
I'll stick to my guns. My information is on that particular figure comes from the director of the Stockholm Peace Studies Institute this summer. And frankly, however, if you choose to believe 2 tons, I won't quibble. That should be sufficient, I would think. One of the things that we discussed in those sessions was called the hair trigger on the Holocaust. This refers to a very important shift in strategic policy that's occurring both within the United States and within Russia. And that is a strategy largely designed toward targeting missiles, the missiles on the other side, instead of the old deterrence, which was built upon the idea you threaten their cities so they won't dare attack. At first blush, that sounds pretty good. Right? Well, it's a less bloodthirsty strategy. The unfortunate thing about it is it does mean that if you believe that your missiles are under attack, you have to fire them before the enemy missiles reach them. What that means very specifically is that instead of a retaliation and response time of several hours when you could assess the situation a little bit and make some kind of judgment before choosing how you were going to respond to this attack, the time has been boiled down to 17 minutes. All right? Unfortunately, even 17 minutes is not the minimum amount of time that is now being discussed. It's not important in this. In fact, it's probably, in many situations, since we have submarines closer than Soviet firings, and since we have missiles in Europe that we have to protect, we're moving toward a system where satellites will make the decision, computers on board satellites, will make the decision whether or not to fire nuclear missiles within 3 minutes of initial observations and without any human intervention whatsoever. The problem with this, of course, is that computers and computer programs and humans are fallible, and there simply is not enough give in the system. It really has moved us towards a much more dangerous posture. All right. It has a lot to do with why the arms on that clock went from about 9 minutes to midnight, which was during the time, up very suddenly to this new figure, the shift in policy. Okay, as far as the future, by current plans, it's estimated that there will be 90,000 warheads by the year 2000. The arms race in that context is definitely escalating. We're talking about a military expenditure in the next 5 years of $1.5 to $1.8 trillion. That's almost as much as we've spent since 1947 in equal dollar values. All right. All of this has also happened at enormous economic, social, and psychological costs. While our real security, due to this counterforce, and due largely just to the number of weapons and the number of systems that could break down and go wrong, plus the increased tension, our security for all of this has been declining. We looked at a few of the things which propel the arms race. We talked a little bit about fear, political gain, greed, misinformation, obsolete thought, specialization, technology, inertia, and nice guys doing a good job as a number of factors. Unfortunately, all of this is leading us very probably to a nuclear war that nobody wants, and a war that would be started possibly by intention if, for example, an adversary felt that nuclear war was inevitable and was forced to decide to take their best shot. Okay? Accident. We've come very close in the last couple of years to system failures. People have put, in one instance particularly, a War Games computer tape was put on the launch on warning computer. All right? Result of that was we got 6 minutes into that 17-minute pre-launch cycle. They were on their way to find the president when they finally realized that it was a computer error. Very close, 11 minutes from nuclear war at that time. The possibility of escalation of a smaller war is another very real consideration, especially with the fact that we have 11 wars currently going on in the world at the moment. And finally, terrorism, part of nuclear proliferation. Okay. Now, before we open this up, I would like to read something which speaks directly to us as a Christian community, and I think will be helpful to our discussion tonight and helpful in helping us realize a little bit about the dimensions of this particular problem. This is written by a man named Dale Alkerman. I know very little about him, but I was struck by what he had to say. The 300 million persons, or a billion, or 4 billion, might be killed in a nuclear war is beyond the imagination of any mortal. My nearest approach to the magnitude of that horror comes when I realized that Jesus would be the central victim in the midst of the annihilation. Each victim he would know, each passion, each death he would feel. He in whom God has drawn near would be there with the least of all who are his in 1,000 infernos. The slain brother would be there with every brother and sister, with every terrified child, as the slower ghastliness of radiation sickness spreads across the continents. A darkness more enduring than that on long ago Passover would cross the world. From innumerable parched lips would come some echo of the cry, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? So, with that, I'd like to open up the floor to responses. Remember, our question tonight is, how do we prevent the nuclear war? Yes?
I've come to believe, in the last several months to a year, that it's just about inevitable. And of the major powers that are going to be destroyed, one of these days we'll turn around and 15 minutes later most of us won't be there. We, as a nation, unfortunately, have taken on many burdens, some of which perhaps we shouldn't, but we have taken them on, and unfortunately there seems to be a collision course. And if there isn't an accident, and if there isn't a small power proliferation turning into a major war, we probably, within just the major powers, will cause it ourselves. And I don't see how we can, without God's mercy and grace, prevent what is beginning to seem terrible and inevitable.
Okay. The Stockholm Peace Institute would tend to agree with that. They believe that unless something changes, now this is very similar to what John was talking about the other night. This is a prediction based on current trends. Unless something changes, a major nuclear confrontation will occur, probability of one, in the first half of the next century, before the first half of the next century. Any response to that? Anybody with another opinion?
Peter?
Yes.
I think maybe a lot of people here heard this a couple of weeks ago or 2 weeks ago at a forum, but when a guest said something that his congressman had said, it just struck me is that I always have thought of a nuclear war as a World War II being fought with nuclear weapons. And it's just such a ridiculous kind of image, because it will be 15, 17 minutes and most of the world will be gone. It's not just using nuclear weapons instead of rifles or whatever.
Very good. Albert Einstein, one of his favorite, one of his most noted quotes was, and I have to paraphrase, with the advent of the explosion of the first nuclear weapon, everything changed but the way mankind thinks. You're familiar with the Maginot Line in World War II and how World War I thinking applied to that situation and didn't work with a hoot. Well, there's still a lot of thinking that's World War II thinking that's being applied to this new generation of weapons. It does not apply. Ron.
Is there, how well do we know how the Russian people perceive the problem?
We knew quite a bit more during the SALT negotiations and during the era of detente. One of the things that has been very distressing about current trends is that the cultural exchanges and the exchanges of information. In Vienna, when they were meeting, the KGB and the CIA sit down and have coffee together. Seriously. I know people who are on the negotiating team. And it was an excellent period for kind of breaking down some of that misinformation. At this time, it's a little hard to say. Most reports, frankly, that I get back from the Soviet Union, or that I hear about, I don't have people directly reporting them, in case you were wondering, most of the reports that I hear are that, by and large, the people in the Soviet Union sincerely and deeply desire peace. That country lost 20 million people in the last war. There's hardly a family in Russia that didn't have an uncle or a brother or a father or a son who was killed in this. There are war museums in every city of any size, and they bring their young to see these the horrible things. Okay?
Pardon me, that wasn't really what I meant, though. Do the Russians, do you have any feeling that the Russians, that there's a segment of the Russian population that feels nuclear war is inevitable, like some people, and many of us, of course, feel?
I really can't accurately respond to that. I do not know.
Here, is there any reason to think that the seat of power, the seat of authority, Washington, D.C., in other words, is any less concerned, Christian or not, than we are here?
Anybody else care to respond to that? I heard some murmuring from the peanut gallery up here.
I'd like to try, and then I'd like some help. My feeling is that the concern has many expressions, and that there are some forms of concern that I regard as being more productive or more conducive to supporting my desire to feel hope about the future. And that conversation is at least a minimum standard. And when I don't feel like that's even occurring, I begin to doubt the content of that concern, whether or not it is verbally expressed, which Reagan certainly did when he was running.
I don't follow what you're saying there.
It's not clear to me that Reagan is taking actions that in any way make me feel confident that anything is happening that opposes a trend toward nuclear war. It's not clear to me what action is being taken that opposes that trend. Cruise missiles and MX missiles and neutron bombs and all of the development that is clearly a part of the Reagan policy, I can see.
John?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm speaking exactly to the conversation Bob and Steve are having, but I may be. There are people, and it seems to me the present administration among them, and people who come to Holden, and probably people in this room, who answer your question by saying, the best way to prevent nuclear war is for us to build up such a nuclear arsenal that no one would dare attack us. In other words, I think there are people who honestly believe that they can answer your first two questions affirmatively, that they do not want a nuclear war, and that they believe our job is to be peacemakers, and that Christ calls us to love, and are in favor of the arms race as the way to peace.
John, I've met them.
there's lots. So I think Bob's question, is there any reason to think that those in Washington are less concerned than we, is a judgment statement that I'm not sure I'm willing to make. That they have a very different answer from mine, I think I can speak to without that being we just have a difference of opinion on what it means to be a peacemaker. And I think that's part of what a forum is all about. But there's no, is that help at all, Bob, or not?
I didn't mean to imply that let's call it the central authority, because I include that not only the administration, but the Congress. I did not mean to imply either one or the other, that the central authority was either for or against an arms race. I meant only to ask the question, was the concern any less?
Yeah.
Without any implication as to the direction that concern might take.
I think the concern is very real. And once again, John's point is excellent. We're not in a position to really judge levels of concern and say somebody is unconcerned. My senior pastor likes to point out that where we get is determined by the roads we go down, not by the goals we set. And when you look at every single president since Eisenhower and what they've had to say in warning us about the terrors of the nuclear weapons and how we must try and rid the world of them, the statements, all of them, are eloquent and beautiful and very encouraging. But the fact is, under every single administration, the arms race is escalated. I think what we have to get to here tonight, I'm going to steer this a little bit, is the question, how do we prevent nuclear war? Ron.
Of course, I think many people that want to increase our number of arms will say that, of course, the goals of the communist, of Russia, the communist world, is world domination, and that if we did continue to match them, at least, that would become a riskier situation.
Okay.
How would you answer that criticism?
Very good. I do have an answer to that, but I don't want to hog the show tonight. Does anybody else care to respond to Ron? Okay. My answer to that is twofold. First one is sufficiency. Okay. What your implication would seem to be is that the Russians may attack us, all right? To further, well, is that part of it?
If we didn't keep up with them, that'd be the argument.
Okay.
If they felt that that they were, of course, I realize, I've heard that there's enough TNT and so forth to kill everybody in the world a number of times over,
yes.
But relatively speaking, if they got so far ahead of us, they could blackmail us. I mean, this argument has been.
Okay, without being facetious, and I know it sounds bad, but we're in a situation, have been since the early 1960s, of bang your dead, bang your debtor. And Robert McNamara in 1967 commissioned a major study on the deterrent force that was needed to make any attack on the part of the Russians to be suicidal. And he determined that 100 nuclear missiles, 100 nuclear warheads would be adequate, and that would kill a minimum of 39 million people, knock out 59% of their industrial capacity. Now what we have here, just looking at the strategic, okay, we've got 10 times that, all right? That's it's just in that end of it. And we're planning to, our plans are for 15,000 more, okay? The big question is that even if we accept your point, and I'd be willing to accept your point, that you don't have to give the Russians any credit. You can give them the worst possible motives, except maybe suicide. And we are still way beyond any rational or reasonable amount of weapons to contain them and to prevent it. That would be my answer. Anybody else? Yes.
Well, I've heard you mention that before, but if the possibility of an accident could occur, is it any more comforting to know that we're only going to fire off 100 or 200 or whatever? I mean, it seems like your program still is the bang your dead. It's what have you gained to do with the bang your debtor? Your program still should be toward eliminating the threat altogether. It doesn't make me feel any better.
Certainly. Certainly. I understand what you're getting at, and I would agree with you. Once again, I'm not going to try and comment on all this stuff either, but first of all, at this point, we're racing headlong in the other direction, all right? I'd love to be able to sit down and meaningfully discuss whether we can get below the level of overkill, whether we can really get back to, you know, win-lose type of situation, or to disarmament altogether. I'd love to be able to discuss that. At this point, we're heading so far and so fast in the other direction that we can't do that. The bang your debtor thing is basically a fact that we're in a situation now where the weapons themselves are the big threat. If you only have 100, you have, you know, 100th time the chance of an accident or something that you have with 1,000. Okay.
I think the other half of the equation too is with 100 weapons as opposed to thousands, it really is an economic equation. With keeping limitations, you've got freed up monies to put into
Social and Human Services, you've got undoubtedly some significant effect on our inflation rate. You can begin to address needs in other parts of the world, all of which have to be as or even more important to our security. Because if we're not strong economically, if we're not viewed with respect by the rest of the world, then what good are these weapons going to be?
Okay. Yes, all right.
Well, ever since World War II, when we exploded the atomic bomb and then went ahead with the hydrogen, it was on the theory that we would have enough power that we could control Russia. But that hasn't proven out in a single case. They have simply caught up with us. We've gone ahead, and there has been no security in it. I think I read an article once where Napoleon said that you can do anything with a bayonet except sit on it. And you can do anything with an atomic bomb except use it. The atomic bomb, the hydrogen bomb, all our missiles didn't keep the Koreans out of South Korea. We had it. And it, we're sitting, and still we're going to make more of it. 3 or 4 a day. And now this boondoggle MX coming along, where we're going to enormously increase that. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, George Kennan referred to the nuclear weapons as the dumbest weapon ever built.
I think one aspect of it is that the term communist, Russian, is such a red flag. And I was talking with, we were talking with, my wife and I were talking with a couple of days, and he was surprised to learn that American and Russian authors have had meetings. They've met in Russia. They've met in the United States. They learned from there that they're against war. That we learned from there that the man was particularly surprised when he learned that 20 million volumes of fictional literature and so on has gone into Russia. They read that. I think it's got to be an understanding that the Russian Cold War, we've been pursuing this policy, the Pentagon and the Russians have had a symbiotic relationship. We do it, they do it. They do it, we do it. And it's continued for the last 40 years.
And that's a very good point. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Just to add a little bit to that from my own personal experience, having served in the Air Force overseas in England in 73 and around that era, the major concern of the war games and all the everything that went along with that, it had very little to do with nuclear at that point, but just with the major concern about containing a Russian offensive in Europe. And so it seemed to me that the people that I was associated with viewed those weapons, the atomic weapons, primarily as unusable, and were just very concerned about how to operate on the lower level. Mm-hmm. But to make it into a question, Christianity in Crisis had an article or a play called Dunbar's Brain, and it talked a lot about use of very small tactical weapons, and made it sound very logically like that could easily occur without immediate escalation, at least. I haven't heard much discussed in the last 3 days about that aspect of war.
It's a very important aspect. Yes.
That's pretty much the point I speak to. You just mentioned that small tactical weapons are a possibility, with the possibility it wouldn't escalate into a major overall conflict. Of course, that's trading a lot on hope, but it might be the only hope. If it was a small power nuclear accident or confrontation, it might be so terrific, even though it was small, that it, or even the tactical weapon situation, that maybe it would be so horrible, it would be the one thing that would enable us to get rid of thermonuclear weaponry. It's the only hope that I see, because unless we have some sort of a terrible thing that at least doesn't destroy the world, all these nations are not going to accept that they have to get rid of it.
I think that's a good point. I'd like to remind you that we've had two major explosions.
Yeah, I was thinking Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Yeah.
It wasn't enough. It was too long ago.
As far as mistakes go, it makes sense to reduce the number of nuclear weapons. But that if an escape occurs, there really isn't a whole lot you can do about that anyway, outside of just keeping up with technology. What frightens me perhaps even more is intent. Just the basic idea of having a small tactical nuclear weapon and having a limited nuclear engagement. I don't know if anyone saw a CBS News broadcast many months ago and had an excellent hour and a half segment on limited nuclear engagement. And basically, when you're using a small tactical weapon, like a nuclear weapon, you have to be the first on the button. And so it gets down to intent. You're on to the other guy right when it comes up to you feeling like you have a nuclear engagement. And our technology has turned that around in the last 3 years. That's the way the mindset is between the Soviet Union and the United States. What I'm wondering, it's just an open question, is how can we turn that mindset around?
I'm glad to hear you say that, because in 1932, we have about 25 minutes yet, and I guess we're anybody attempt to answer the question. What can we do to prevent nuclear? What do we want to do it? Some people have ideas. Anybody? Yes.
So, I guess I wish that if it's going off season, just to say, what would be so awful about living under the communist condition that we are? If you see everything through the promise of change, the promise of change, so what is so change? What is the Christian church about if we don't have a God of this thing we need trust? We do not trust God. We don't act like we are Christian church to God about it. Very few people do. We just assume that we have to be pragmatic and we have to think about the rest of the world. I think something we could do is among Christian people just to keep pushing and pushing and pushing to say there is a God who can make his church turn out right. Yeah, we might have to suffer, but at least, you know, we're going to try to walk in the way that Jesus asked us to walk. And I just think I don't see us ever doing anything except trying to be extremely pragmatic and secure. And if our security is the same security as the nation,
Maybe the kind of decisions that we will make, and the kind of reason we'll make, and the reason we'll make will be based on economics. But if we're going to get to choose what we're telling, then how are you going to change our economic structure? How do we get to be able to alleviate our dependency on foreign oil? And change around all of those without meaning.
I'm really scared right now, but it's I think if you can present it in that way to people in our home system,
We want to do more than the ultimate strength. And to destroy the point of our tactics, to our inactions, to the reality of the reason for the lack of our potential, that we dare back to it. What power is that for us that we're achieving, that we're willing to lose?
As I understand it, our question is what to do to make you aware. One short test that you might have noticed is the voice. Not that anything is going to work for you by a voice. One answer was, well, I can get up, be willing to test, be willing to surrender, be willing to let the labor and charge take over, and test that it really is what I am. We, like many other nations, have a lot of guilt, but we also have a lot of judgment. And I just don't see that as either a realistic, practical answer or one that I think it's reasonable to try to. There might be another possibility or two or three. One, we find ways of working together. Neither of us can have an agreement. Neither of us can have the same truth, when they have the same truth, when they develop intimacy, economic, and social, and cultural ties, they can know each other better. This is going to be within churches, within communities, within the city children. And if we find ways of reconciliation, accommodation, it might be through this type of thing as an alternative that we would develop an understanding in order to make these the world not necessary. And I think of hope.
If that ceiling is so high, perhaps we could expect
agreement on weapons being made of cotton.
The Vietnam War is not justifiable.
it didn't meet any of the six traditional criteria for a justifiable war. We do not know that tradition well. We do not benefit from, we just said, in the last 30 years, a lot has been written. In the last 1,000 years, that tradition is really is meant to be a helpful one for us. I just wanted to say that I'm picking up on Randy, that the nuclear age has brought a very different approach. I don't have a choice anymore if I want to be a good Lutheran. I don't have a choice anymore as to whether or not I might have been a pacifist or a Mennonite. According to my tradition, at least two of the criteria, law of proportionality, you never do more damage than the good you hope to do by starting the conflict. Well, nuclear, I don't know how to weigh anything against the destruction of the world. And the other is non-combatant and not to be injured. That's one of the six criteria. On those two, and I could go into the other six, and I'm not sure any of them, but at least on those two, if I'm going to be faithful to the tradition that has been part of my branch of the Christian Church, I would have to say I cannot participate or support nuclear war. I don't hear as much going into that which has been talked to for a while. It always sounds so non-traditional to some people to be opposed to nuclear war, like you're not faithful to the military chaplains who served in World War I, and Lutherans have not been pacifists in one another. I'm not sure, but what I'm doing is very traditional. And I'm opposed to participation in nuclear armies.
Could you please tell some of us what
the headers for are? Well, I'm not sure that's the point of the form. I'll be glad to do it if there's time or have attention on it. But there are some criteria that are necessary before you enter it. There are criteria necessary during the conducting of it. And there's at least the one criteria, anti, the after is over, that's mercy to the vanquished. The United States has been good on the last one. But in the first one, you shall not enter it unless it's declared by the constituted authority. That's Vietnam didn't even come in under that one. Congress never declared war. And you shall apply all other peaceful means. Well, that's a tough one, but anyway, you should have tried salt free, you should have tried to negotiate whatever. During it, the law of proportionality, you don't want to do more damage than the good you intended to do. Non-combatants should not be injured or affected. And I think there's a third one. Sorry, I can't remember the third one. And then mercy to the vanquished is the one that says two before you enter, three during it, and one at the end. There are listed several different times by several different people, but that's a third one.
Okay, we've got about 1 minute left. I'd like to ask 30 seconds. I put it down in here finally and then you see. That's the final option. I'll quote one of the folks that Jack Ledbetter handed me during Veterans Day. And it was a quote from 1902, I think it applies very closely to what we're talking about. It was the rule that you can make up your mind what you want, be for a word, and then just let you say what you want.